Welcome to Mustard Analytics. I am Matt.
I'm Richard.
And we discuss things in the entertainment world that, however briefly, capture our interest.
That's right.
Movies, TV, DVDs, video games, whatever Apple's doing.
Shoehorn
that in. So last week we discussed the rumor of the Hulk and Ed Norton. And immediately after I went home, you sent me an email saying, Reuters, dude.
Reuters.
Reuters, dude. Reuters. Mm-hmm. Where apparently it was not a rumor, but was confirmed that Ed Norton was going to be the Hulk in a movie directed by the dude who did Transporter and Transporter 2. And
yep, whatever other stupid thing.
Crank.
Probably Crank.
And, you know, my opinion is still the same as last week. I can't fathom how Ed Norton wants to work with this director. And obviously we discussed that the discerning actors every so often want a big frickin' payday, and they deserve it. It's just, Ed Norton doesn't seem like one of those guys, but here we are.
Yeah.
I can't, there's no other way for me to look at this.
Well, I just don't get, I mean, you read the whole Avi Arad interview, or did you hear about that, where he's saying...
I saw the blurb about how he's going to be gray.
He's going to be
green.
And then I saw some of these original pictures, the original Hulk, where he was gray. And I look at that and I go, I'm honestly, and I don't, and I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, but I honest to God am stunned by that. Because I think what everybody is saying is, what's so weird is I liked the last Hulk movie, and everybody has to, you hear other people just, they'll say, oh, this was bad, but they generally liked it. Although, but in it's this general perception, it was this horrible thing or whatever. But the agreement everybody seemed to come up with is, we need to make Hulk Hulk. He needs to smash more things. He needs to do this and that. So what are they saying when they're doing a new one? We're going to go against the few things that are like the one thing that everybody knows about Hulk is that he's freaking green. So I don't know. I'm just kind of stunned that they're even. I don't know what they're thinking, because to me that's a really weird misstep to even be throwing out there right now. It just is weird.
I mean, I know a bit from the comic perspective in terms of the first 8 issues of the Hulk, he was gray.
Yep.
I can't remember what justification there was for
supposedly,
him suddenly being green.
Supposedly, the justification was they couldn't print the gray very effectively, so they switched to green.
I'll buy that.
It was
that
a practical concern. But to me, it doesn't matter. Hulk, what color is Hulk? Hulk is green. And I don't care if you're sitting here saying, oh, we went back and looked at the red. I'm just going, you know.
But I'm not quite finished.
Okay.
There was a lengthy run of the comics where he was gray.
Yeah.
Now, granted, most people don't know that, and you're exactly right. To the general population, the Hulk is green. For people who are into the comics, they can understand that he's gray or green. But, yeah, when you're making a movie with mass appeal, I agree, he should be green. Otherwise, you're just confusing people.
I mean, when Superman came out, he would just jump. He wouldn't even fly.
Yeah.
And he would go after bad guys and their guns and their bullets. And if they had done Superman now, well, we're doing Superman. We better go to the beginning and Superman just jumps. I'm thinking, great, you idiot. Thanks for ruining it. And that's what I'm looking at here. If that's their reason, because they're trying to get back to the original, I'm going, dude, there's other original things you can get back to.
I guess, I don't know. And then there was after the Ang Lee movie, and there was, which I enjoyed, mm-hmm. I totally got what he was going for, and while it didn't necessarily always work, I really enjoyed it as something different and new.
Yep.
And I thought it mostly worked.
Yep.
And what else was I going to say? But there was this reaction, are they going to do another one? And, well, if we do, it's going to be Hulk Smash.
Yeah.
Which, to some degree, you know, it's all in the same flavor as the gray thing. That's the general perception in the public, is that the Hulk smashes, even though in the comic, the character's been up and down and done so many different things, but like one of my favorite writers, Peter David, actually is the writer who has had the longest run of writing Hulk issues,
mm-hmm.
And he wrote them very intelligent and had various issues, and there was multiple personality disorder and lots of interesting things going on, but it was anything but Hulk Smash, because Peter David thought that was really boring.
Yeah.
And he's right. And, you know, talking about how we'd always get fan mail, like, when is the Hulk going to fight the Abomination, or when is the Hulk going to fight this, or when is the Hulk going to fight the Rhino? And he says, well, honestly, who cares? It's the Hulk's book. You know the Hulk is going to win. Who cares?
Yeah.
And so he would try and find more interesting things to do with the Hulk, which I think he succeeded in doing. But the general perception is Hulk Smash. So, you know, it'll be really interesting to see what happens. I'll see it, you know, whatever. I enjoy Ed Norton. But it's, I'm going at it from such a low expectations perspective.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it'll be great and fun and exciting. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it. I don't give a crap about the director. I mean, the thing about the director is, and those movies were awful, but they had scenes in them that in of themselves were just crazy in their execution and how, I mean, just comically funny. And I mean that in a good way of some car. There was like a bomb strapped to the bottom of this car.
I know exactly where you're going.
And it's like rolling in space as some, I mean, it was the craziest thing. And I'm thinking there's a certain amount of panache to develop a set piece like that. And if they hire a really good writer for the Hulk, and then they let this director loose on developing these cool set pieces, and I just, I'm thinking, I might be really interested in that.
Well, I completely concur. Anything with a really good writer is going to rock. But when you look at the track record of this director,
yeah,
you kind of have to wonder.
Yeah, and I never saw saw Crank, but I did see this one scene from it that was quite possibly the stupidest thing ever. It was supposedly he's got this thing in her where he needs to keep his adrenaline and his heart pumping. And then at one point, to get his heart pumping, he's at some racetrack, some horse racetrack, and he like grabs Amy Smart and starts having sex with her in front of this crowd of other people. While they're all, where everybody's watching, so he can keep his heart rate up. He's like standing there having this, and it's the most comical, stupid, like stuff where they're like screwing in front of like 30 people as they're all cheering him on. It's so dumb. To a certain extent, his argument would probably be, of course it's dumb. That's the whole point of this movie. But it was like, no, it was like dumber than that. It was like a different level of dumb that was almost, was unenjoyable. Anyway.
Hot Fuzz opened this weekend
by
the
guys
who did
Shaun
of the Dead. John enjoyed it,
yep.
Said it was very funny, gave it a thumbs up.
Got a lot of good reviews.
Fracture opened this weekend. I'm interested in seeing that, but I haven't seen any reviews or seen the Rotten Tomato.
It's gotten pretty good reviews. Ryan Gosling gets really good reviews. I don't even know what it's about.
Anthony Hopkins basically kills his wife, tells everyone he killed, evidence doesn't back him up, so it's...
That's right.
And it, you know what? It looks interesting, but it could easily go either way.
And it's Gosling's first... Well, I guess The Notebook was a big picture movie, but his first real... It's all about him. It's not the story. He's like the co-lead actor. It's his foray into like superstardom after being like this hot indie actor, which is interesting. He's a good actor. He was in this movie I saw many years ago. What the hell? Oh, The Believer. It's a true story based on this Jewish kid. Actually, lived in the 60s, but they moved it up, who basically became a neo-Nazi. And he and the internal contradictions of this guy. And Gosling was just, like, ferocious and awesome and incredible. And I know he got nominated for an Oscar. I heard that Half Nelson, he was super good. So I see just about anything he's in, although this here is 100% definitely, I'll see it when it comes out in DVD.
Yeah. I saw a blurb. They're actually finishing filming the last few episodes of Studio 60.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like there was like three or four episodes left to round out the 22.
Wow.
22 episodes.
That must be some weird thing where they just decided for fun or for, because usually no matter what, it's cheaper just to write
those
things off.
And then the blurb went on to say, but of course they probably won't be seen unless they release until they release the DVD set.
So they're clearly doing that. Oh, that's weird. They're clearly doing that to sell DVDs for people like you and me that enjoyed the series and going, and the only way we're going
to
see this.
What a fine line to walk, where they decide it's worth it enough to finish filming these episodes, but not enough to broadcast what they have in the can. That is just...
Is there any that were filmed that we didn't see?
Yeah, there were like six or nine.
Oh.
I can't remember what the number was, but it was at least six episodes that were not broadcast.
Well, there's a possibility they might just be putting him on hold for a, even though it's canceled for a, like a fill in, but sounds more like they're just trying to fill out a DVD. Well, thing.
And the same article mentioned that the fill in, the other mid-season replacement shows really weren't doing any better.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, it didn't specifically say anything about the Black Donnellys, which was what replaced it, but,
yeah.
Yeah, I just find that very odd. And think, talk about what a weird mood on set.
I know
you've been, it's not just that you think you're being canceled and there's a sense of dread. You're almost positive. I mean, there's 99.9% possibility what you're working on will only be seen on DVD. I mean, what a weird sense that must be. What a weird environment to create or film under.
And you wonder, you know, every single TV show, every single time you film something like that, it's a whole series of negotiations with the line producer on spending money. And it's always, this little thing, it's going to make this thing better. We want to go out to this podunk Nevada or wherever. We want to film this little scene. We want to do this and that. Once the show's canceled like that, the line producer wins every argument, every one. And so there is no let's make it effort. So I wonder if we look at these shows, if they're going to be entirely bound on that set. Everything's going to be filmed on that set. You'll not see much beyond that and other little things like that.
I totally understand what you're
saying.
I don't
think it's bad or good. I'm just saying that it just adds a dynamic because suddenly they're literally the cheapest they can do this, the happier everybody would be. So, and that's not a good or bad thing, but they're going to make sure that script entirely takes place in the confines of that set. It's probably some bigger, longer scenes that don't have a lot of complicated tracking. So instead of a 12-day shoot, it's a 10-day shoot. You know, there's probably all kinds of little factors that are going to go into making that a pretty, you know, quick and easy show. But maybe I'm wrong.
I also saw the Drive on Fox.
Oh, yeah.
The secret cross-country road race.
I want to see that. It looks good.
Here's where they screwed up, though. You know, I set my system to tape it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't set it to tape all new episodes of it. I just wanted to see the first one, see if it was any good, then make a decision.
Yep.
So it was on Sunday night for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't get around to watching it till Friday night and Saturday morning.
Yep.
So, and I'm like, okay, yeah. And then they get to the end of it, and they're like, and don't forget to tune in tomorrow. It drives new night and time.
Mm,
and I'm like, you jackasses.
Why don't you set a season pass?
Well, I didn't know if I wanted to.
Oh, well, what's it, just taking up space on your hard drive?
I know, but still, it bugs me when I have to go through and delete things that on accident. I understand it's only a few extra clicks and menu selections away, but to me, I really hate being sucked into new TV.
Yeah.
Because I already watch too much TV, trying to watch less of it.
Yeah, I hear you.
So I'm very like, well, I'm only going to record one. That makes it okay.
Yep.
But, you know, it's got Nathan Fillion, who was in Firefly, and got to watch. And it's, you know, done by this one of the same executive producers, Tim Minear.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that really pissed me off. So right now my computer is BitTorrenting that episode because I feel like they screwed me.
Well, they did.
They made such a big deal about, you know, see the special night and time of the premiere of Drive. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be awesome. I don't recall ever having, you know, like a special night and time followed the next day by the next episode.
Yep.
I don't ever remember that happening. I figured there'd be at least a week or 2 weeks.
I've seen them before where they'll do that. They'll actually, what they'll do is I'll have a special premiere, and then in the new night and time, they'll actually show the premiere again.
Yeah, they'll rerun it in case you didn't. Yeah. That way they can say, it was America's most watched new show about cars.
Exactly.
Now's your chance to
catch
up.
And then they'll add up the two, you know, they'll say 14 million people. Well, whatever. They just add the two numbers together. It's kind of goofy how they do that.
Anyway, it seems like a pretty good show in terms of, they do a lot of interesting camera work around these cars driving around, and some of it was very... Remember that shot in War of the Worlds around the minivan?
Yeah.
That tracked around and then pushed in?
Yeah.
They actually did some of the pushing in. The tracking wasn't quite as elaborate, but anyway, and it seems, you know, pretty interesting. Although the main problem they're going to have is that almost by necessity, all of the characters right now are one-dimensional.
Yeah.
And unless they really puff that out, you know, oh, that's the shrill woman, and oh, that's the chick with secrets that's working against her boyfriend, and you know, it's all just, you can immediately identify each arch.
It's hard to do a series because you gotta suck people in initially. So you got to come up with these stupid stereotypes. So you got to hopefully not let them linger too much. But yeah, it's hard.
Yeah,
it must be hard.
I say that knowing full well I would never be able to write good characterization and flesh out characters like that.
Sometimes I'll watch Saturday Night Live and it'll just be so bad. But I'll sit back and I'll go, you know, honestly, the guys in those rooms are really funny people. It's got to be really, really hard to do that. And so I tend to try to give them more credit than maybe sometimes they deserve, because, you know, after watching Studio 60 and reading enough interviews about that, they're trying really hard to do something funny, even if it's just horrible. And sometimes you watch Saturday Night Live and literally a third of it, you don't even snicker. It's just terrible. But you know that there's a lot of people in that room. They're doing their best. You know, I don't look and go, oh, I could clearly do better. I look and I go, wow, it's just hard to do. Anyway,
what else? Oh, I saw a blurb this morning that Sam Raimi has confirmed that Sony wants to do
4, 5, and 6.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that
yesterday. It's interesting. There's been blurbs back and forth about Tobey Maguire saying not interested. And, well, I don't know, maybe. And Sam Raimi saying the same thing. And no one has really confirmed anything.
I don't think Raimi will be back. I think that they want to
let's just do
three more and let's just revamp it and do whatever.
I would guess that at this point they want to low budget it as much as possible.
Yep.
And, you know, and sort of ride the coattails of the first three where they made the investment of budget. But now it's like, well, if we bring back Raimi and Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst, it's going to cost us a bloody fortune.
Yeah, and there's...
And then they say, you know what? People aren't coming to see Tobey Maguire. They're coming to see whoever's in the friggin' suit.
Yeah, and if we just restart it with somebody else... Somebody made a good point. They were... as reading where they were talking about the Hulk, and it just seems so weird because the other Hulk seems so fresh in our mind, and they're literally not a sequel. They're just... It's just another Hulk with a new... Sort of a new direction or whatever, and they're saying, you know, it's going to be, when it comes out, like, 6 years after the last Hulk, that it was only like 6 years from Christopher Nolan's Batman since the previous Batman, which so it's not like it's been like, oh my God, they directed one and then next year they've done this whole different direction. It's not that much different. I mean, the one difference is there wasn't a series of Hulks and now we're doing a new kind of Hulk. But it's not like it just happened yesterday. For whatever reason, the Hulk feels like it was recent, but by the time the new one comes out, it'll be like 6 years.
God, and just to go back, Jeff Wells said something about, you know, never mind, Ang Lee killed the franchise, nothing interesting will ever happen with it. And I'm like, really? Maybe that's, what an elitist argument.
Yeah.
Who cares? Nobody's going to hold the previous Hulk against the new Hulk.
He doesn't understand or get comic book movies anyway, so...
Anyway, something else I saw this morning, apparently Terry Gilliam is working on his Don Quixote script.
Gilliam, really?
Gilliam Gilliam.
So has he somehow bought back the ability to own this thing, or...?
Boy, what a... You gotta give him credit, he keeps chugging away.
Absolutely.
My God. He went through hell to try and make that the first time.
That movie about it was great. That just, I just have such vivid memories of the storms and they're going out to the hottest place in the world where there's no rain ever. And then they have this torrential downpour that's blowing away their set. And it's like, man, what a great movie. I don't know that his movie would be that great because, I mean, I look at like the Brothers Grimm and others. And I'm going, wow, this is a guy who's lost whatever vision he had. But the movie about the making of his movie, I think the smartest thing he can do is whatever movie he does from here on out is always hire some film crew to film the making of it and let them do an honest portrayal, because it's going to put out, at the very worst, a real interesting movie. Anyway,
and somewhat ironically, because we were talking about Sahara last week, did you see the thing on Hollywood Elsewhere where somebody had actually found the actual budget breakdown?
Oh yeah, they've released that. And that stuff is really secretive normally.
Because the studios hate releasing that.
Absolutely, because they don't want to admit, because it's a studio's interest in a myriad ways to make it look like no matter how successful the movie is, it hasn't made any money.
Right.
That was sort of the famous case of Coming to America.
Yes, with I completely agree.
Art Buchwald. That movie made $240 million, yet it never turned a profit. Art Buchwald successfully sued Coming to America saying, you stole my idea. And he won. He came up with a deal with them, and they said, you're going to get a certain percentage of the net profits. Yet, as he found out, there's no such thing as net profits in Hollywood. One of the most successful comedies of all time, which did not cost that much to make, was perpetually, not making a profit. And with Sahara, they were focusing on was things like the personal trainer of Matthew McConaughey and the hair person. It's like, yeah, that's just pretty standard. And I'll tell you right now, making of the movie, the point to that movie was Matthew McConaughey, they wanted women to go see this thing, and he needed to look good. I don't have a huge problem with factoring in $100,000 for a personal trainer to get him to look good if that's what you're trying to do. The weird thing was is that they put together a movie with not A-list stars. Matthew McConaughey has never been huge, and that was a point that was a smaller point in his career, and they're putting him... And they're putting Steve Zahn, and they're putting Penelope Cruz, and it's like these are kind of lower list people, yet they're paying McConaughey $8 million, and it just struck me as weird. And it also struck me as I must be the only person that enjoyed this movie. I liked the movie.
I liked it, as we've discussed.
But I was stunned by how much they actually spent on this movie, and how there was like a 42-minute plane crash sequence that they spent $2 million on, and then they just decided to cut it.
I didn't see anything about the length of the scene.
They said it was 42 seconds long or something
like
that. You just
said 42 minutes.
Or, I'm sorry, not minutes. I'm sorry, 42 seconds long. Very short thing that they decided, and it was like in London or something, they decided to cut this thing, which I understand, but God dang, if you're going to spend that much on something, at least throw it on the DVD and the extras or something. But I was actually stunned looking at that. I enjoyed the movie. I thought, you know, Michael Eisner's son, obviously his nepotism, but it seemed it was well done.
Yeah.
But I was struck by how, looking back at the movie, I don't get how it could have possibly cost that much money. You know, it just seems like, that's the equivalent of, you know, the Lord of the Rings movies each cost an average of about $65 million. And this one movie was almost as much as they spent on the three Lord of the Rings movies. That's incredible. So, anyway.
I saw, and this was really interesting, I saw within the past week two things about Michael Moore's next film, Sicko.
Yeah.
And I just was starting to think, what's going on with that? I haven't heard anything about that.
Well, he's specifically been trying to keep it completely under wraps. He wants to be not on the radar at all.
Well, and
which is smart of him.
I could see. Well, you know, almost immediately after 9/11, it came out that he was saying, this is my next film. This is what it's going to be about.
Yep.
And then you heard nothing. And so,
but you know why? You don't. He doesn't want to give away the movie. I have a friend.
I was going to say, what's to give away? It's about the healthcare
industry. No, that's not it. I have a friend who's in the healthcare industry, and at several times in the past several years, he and others have gotten enormous company-wide letters and emails very specifically explaining about, first, Michael Moore may be coming to interview. You're not supposed to talk. You're not supposed to do this and that. Then production people may be taking you aside. It is probably for this. It is probably for that. Both threatening them not to talk, both doing this and that. The healthcare industry is freaked out. And if Michael Moore was on some crusade about it, it's going to make it a million times harder. It's sort of like Borat. Now, why are we not going to even hear Sacha Baron Cohen for the next 2 years? Because he's got to get into character, and he doesn't want people recognizing him and knowing it. Michael Moore's not a whole lot different.
No, I totally see where you're coming from, and I agree with it. I think it's better for him to be under the radar.
Yeah.
It's just surprising that I haven't seen like an update or heard anything even remotely about it.
Yeah.
So the two things I heard last week were that, one, they were going to Cuba to film something.
Probably show how wonderful their healthcare system is.
Clearly draw some comparison like that, and that it was invited to Cannes.
Oh, so he's pretty, boy, he's like almost finished with it?
Well, so it's interesting that they're still filming, but.
Wow. Damn.
So that's going on, and it'll be, you know, God, Michael Moore just went through media, I don't know if I'd call it media hell, but he was such an easy target after Fahrenheit 9/11, and oh man, it'll be interesting to see what reaction he provokes this time.
Probably exactly the same.
But, you know, it's the healthcare problems are much more relatable. Even it'll be interesting to see if, let's say, knee-jerk conservatives who bought into Rush Limbaugh's hating of Michael Moore will think, well, gosh, I hate his politics, but he's right because I'm going broke paying for my sickness.
Oh, I don't think anybody's going to do that. I think it's the same thing. It's going to be some person wants socialized medicine. And then it doesn't make any difference. You look at the argument. You know, I was watching BBC News the other day right after the Virginia Tech massacre, and you could see the reporter going, well, and they have some of the least I'm not even going to bother the British accent, but the least stringent gun control laws in Virginia. It's very easy to get them, and clearly this will cause a reconsideration. He says kind of smugly, a reconsideration of those laws and this and that. And I'm listening, I'm going, damn, this guy doesn't know America at all. What's going to happen within minutes is you're going to have NRA idiots on TV explaining how, see, here's the problem. The gun laws are too restrictive, and if they allowed students to carry guns, they could have killed this guy. And sure enough, that's exactly what happens. And then the next day on the BBC, they're interviewing a debate, like some NRA wannabe, and then some guy from the Brady Foundation, and the person from the NRA is exactly articulating this. More people need guns to defend them, and the guy from the BBC literally is dumbfounded. He literally doesn't understand the argument. He's like saying that. Well, how this to me relates to Michael Moore is that it does not matter what the argument is. It doesn't matter if nuclear war happens, people still fall back on, well, this is the Republican side and this is the Democrat side. And in healthcare, even though you'd want to argue, let's not talk about politics, political parties, or anything else, they're going to immediately go back on Rush Limbaugh calling it socialized medicine, Rush Limbaugh saying, you know, do you want to do this and that? And then the people like us, we're going to go, wow, he makes a lot of good points. You'd think people would understand. It doesn't make any friggin' difference. The people that need the healthcare, that knee-jerk, well, they're, you know, this socialized medicine, I'm going, you're hurting. I mean, I don't know if you saw the news yesterday. In the South, infant mortality is going up for the first time in ever. And why is it going up? Well, I wonder if there's a connection between the fact that we've cut Medicaid, we've cut all these different ways that we help young people that don't have health insurance. So suddenly now, babies are dying. Well, you know what? I don't think it makes any difference. I think people are just going to say, well, you know, I'm a Republican. I don't believe in that.
It could very well be. Certainly, that's very likely. I just think there is an increasing amount of medical stress and people becoming aware more and more of how much medical insurance is a significant factor in their lives.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's Michael Moore they're going to do. I think it's going to be a practical thing that drives it. It's going to be places like Walmart that have traditionally opposed any efforts to finally go, wow, you know, if we can get government to actually mandate a thing so we're on the same par as all the other employers, well, then at that point, it doesn't become this insane cost that we can't control. It becomes a real fixed cost that is exactly on par with anybody else.
Well, you're talking about the overall healthcare debate. I'm talking just about reaction to his movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I'm not so certain that, I don't know, I'm not so certain. Michael Moore is the classic kind of person that has absolutely no impact on people that don't agree with him. He has... What his value is he takes people that agree with him and gets them fired up and agrees with them more. But Fahrenheit 9/11, I don't think I ever saw or talked to a single person that was, and people that saw this movie, that it remotely did a single thing to influence them at all. It just pissed them off. And then the people like you and me that agreed with Fahrenheit 9/11, it just made us agree with that side more and come up with ammunition examples. But Michael Moore is not a convincer. Al Gore's moment, or his movie, I think it was at least a little more so. I've seen and talked to people that were a little more skeptical, and leaving that felt, no, this, he made sense. He convinced me. But Michael Moore, he is not a convincer. That's not his role, I don't think. I think his role is as a firebrand to get people all excited. But mm-hmm. I don't know. That's my issue.
Look at my phone here for a
second. I was watching this thing about Ralph Nader, and it got me all ticked off about Michael Moore again, because Michael Moore was so pushing Nader in 2000, and then the minute the election went the other way, he started claiming, no, I wasn't. I was trying to divert people there. I'm going, no, you were the steady drumbeat for Nader. And so I started to remember why at the time when I couldn't stand Michael Moore, although it changed once Bowling for Columbine came out. I decided, screw it, I'll like him again. But anyway,
TV shows on the Xbox, vent.
Well, it's not venting. It's like so they created their Xbox Live marketplace. You know, you can buy TV shows, which is cool. Okay, so they did that what, 6 months ago? So
Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving, yeah, like 5 months, or yeah, like 6 months ago.
I'm not correcting you. I'm just throwing that out there. That's when they launched it.
So they put a bunch of shows on there, and it was like kind of like iTunes the first day. Wow, look at all these shows available. Well, then I went and so I got rid of cable like a month ago, and every once in a while I'll be like, geez, I want to watch something, and what do? So I can go on iTunes, but then I'm stuck kind of watching on my computer because I can't afford Apple TV. But then I realized, oh my God, I had like $20 in credits on, because of the horrible, stupid way it works on Xbox. I have these credits. So I decide to go, and of course I have no idea what the dollar value is. I just hate that so much. But anyway, so I go, well, let's go buy something. I start looking through there, and I'm going, great, I can watch the latest episode of or I can watch the latest episode of CSI. In other words, all these shows that literally they put them on 6 months ago and have not updated them since. There's literally nothing, as near as I could tell, hardly nothing or hardly anything new at all.
They added The Daily Show and Colbert.
Well, I don't know if you get a season pass to them, but I not like you can't.
I saw that within the past 2 weeks. So
okay, well, needless to say, there's virtually nothing on there. You go to iTunes and it's a constant drumbeat of new stuff. You go on there, there was nothing. I found myself actually downloading a couple Star Trek episodes. That was the only thing I could find even remotely interesting. And I'm thinking, is this another thing that Microsoft puts together and then just lets wither on the vine?
I doubt it.
I mean, well,
there's got to be licensing troubles or money troubles. I agree. Microsoft famously will pump a product and then let it die. Web TV, Bob. You know, there are examples, but this one is too significant, too much a part of where they want to be, which is your living room.
Well, I will admit that it did download quicker. So this time it downloaded quicker, and unlike it the first time it did it, it's now like iTunes. Once it starts downloading, after like a couple minutes, you can start watching the thing, which is, thank you, finally. So I'm not, because there's nothing worse than downloading and going, okay, in about an hour and a half,
right,
I'm going to start watching this. Well, here I was able to start watching a couple of these episodes pretty quickly. So I felt better for that. But anyway, it was just a maddening experience. I was just looking at that going, God dang, I mean, Microsoft, I have money that I want to spend on you, and you have nothing for me. I found myself playing Test Drive Unlimited instead. You know, it was just crazy. So anyway, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to vent, but it's like, for frig's sake, put something on there, Microsoft. You're the biggest company on the planet.
BBC News. Cinematography of BBC News.
Well, so I've been watching. You know, I sort of download a bunch of podcasts, and the BBC has a lot of very high quality stuff that is available for podcasts. So I tend to download Newsnight, which is their version of the nightly news. And let me tell you, I hadn't watched that in a while. It is, you know, you and I will watch like Top Gear and other stuff, and we'll be stunned at how really clearly good it looks and how it sort of sets the cutting edge standard for what a broadcast or what a program should look like. And the BBC News, they're doing this interview. They're doing this story about Columbine, and then they're interviewing these experts, and I'm looking going, God dang, it's like an HBO documentary or something. The lighting, the angle of this woman who's turned and she's like turned and interviewing somebody with her head sideways, and the angle with the lighting, it was perfect and pristine, and it wasn't so overboard that it looked ridiculous, like it was so moody, but it was so not clearly. I mean, the standard has always been for the last 20 years, if you're doing a daily news broadcast in the universe, somebody, massive lights. You just throw lights on them. Everything's lit like a sitcom. And here it was clearly lit for, I don't know, I'm looking at him going, God dang, this is like a carefully produced documentary they spent months on, when clearly they just set it up this day. So it's clear the BBC camera folks have adapted and learned how to do quick and dirty lighting that looks really good. But it just struck me as kind of jarring, because it almost was as if they were going for an effect. Well, I mean, they were, but it was almost like they were trying to editorialize with their lighting. I don't know. It's just weird. Their broadcasts are, they feel like they're 5 years in the future from an American broadcast. Americans.
Which is funny, because if you look at BBC scripted shows,
yeah,
it can be night and day in terms of their quality.
Well, some of them, I mean, in the old days, they used to be really bad, but. But yeah, this the news broadcast, it feels like I'm looking at the future of American news to a certain extent. It just looks fantastic for like a spot news show. They're going, yeah, we need to interview somebody. Let's make it look good. Let's spend 2 more minutes to make it look good. It's just really interesting. Really interesting.
So I downloaded the Command and Conquer 3 demo.
Yeah.
Which took forever. But, there's 2 missions and I,
is that like a StarCraft game or something, or a Warcraft?
No, it's a little similar to Warcraft 3.
Yeah.
Or I guess it's you know, you click on a unit and tell it to do this, and you've got a base, and you build other buildings.
Yeah, like StarCraft and Warcraft and all those games.
I recall that's what StarCraft was. Oh, I guess you're right.
StarCraft was just like that. What made StarCraft...
I'm confusing that with Star Control.
Okay. Well, what made StarCraft cool was that it was... Often it was 3 different civilizations, so it's not just you versus another. You had to deal with strengths of one and, you know, yada, yada.
So part of the thing with this is, how are they going to mod that sort of, was it real-time strategy?
Yeah.
Real-time strategy control system from mouse and keyboard to a controller, and it's not bad.
Yeah.
But that's definitely one where, for like the first time, it's like, wow, I really wish I had a mouse and a keyboard.
Yeah.
Because it's so much easier with the mouse to do it.
Yep.
But I played through the 2 demo missions and they were fun enough. But the cutscenes are really interesting because they're, on one hand, slickly produced, but they're using these Michael Ironside as the gruff general.
In every single video game.
But they've got him wearing this ridiculous getup, which is brand spanking new. There's no wear on it at all.
Yeah.
And I kind of, looking at the sets, I realize that's part of the problem too, is there's no wear on any of this stuff.
That's too bad, because that was sort of hallmark of cutscenes like 8 years ago, where they hire B-level actors and do that. Nowadays, there's an expectation of a much higher.
Well, and it's the actress from House, and it's Grace Park from Battlestar Galactica, and they've got Sawyer, Josh Holloway from Lost.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all these actors that are currently visible in other projects, but it's so jarring to see them in a video game. And
is that the chunky guy?
No, it's the guy
the doctor.
No.
The shaggy blonde guy.
The
tough guy. Yeah, okay. I haven't seen it in 2 years.
But it's kind of interesting to see these actors, you know, not necessarily badly acting, but just kind of doing a video game cutscene, and you're just like, oh, okay, alrighty.
2 days of work.
It pulls me out of the thing, honestly. It's like, that's the hot doctor from House. I can't buy her as the communications officer from Command and Conquer 3.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I doubt I'll pick up the game, but certainly not for $60. If I had an opportunity to pick it up for cheaper, I probably would. It seemed like I enjoyed it enough that I think Forza 2 is my next actual
purchase. When is that
purchase.
Coming out?
Sometime in May.
Well, if it's a complicated game, I have no interest. If it's this whole, you're tuning this, doing that, it's like, screw that. I just want to push the button down. I want to go. And then I'll pull the other button when I want to stop.
Well, that's what PGR 3 is. That's your racing
game. I hate that, though, man. I hate that one.
Well, that's the racing game.
And what's weird is I played that game quite a bit and got everywhere, and then I looked and realized what their accomplishments are. But I have like 20 points, and I'm going, I played that thing forever, and I got pretty good at some of the games. What do you have to do to...
I'm borrowing another friend's copy, and I looked at their achievement list, and like the first achievement is easy. It's like achieve rank, the lowest rank. So yeah. I did that, and then I looked around, and I was like, achieve the highest rank, okay, and it's like, get all the Ferraris, win all this, buy all that. I was like, well, actually, these are very robust accomplishments. It will take a long time to do these. Like, get every single steel medal, get every single silver medal, get every single gold medal. I'm like, yeah, that'll take a long time.
I was just looking at, not just a long time, I mean, to a certain extent, it's impossible unless you're very good at these kind of games. But anyway, I was just looking at it going... It was almost like, I think achievements, increasingly now the companies are realizing how important those things are to keep doling those out in regular things. And I think that was an early one where I don't think they really thought them through. Honest to God,
I don't think
they did. Which
is interesting because that's an internal title to Microsoft.
Yeah.
It's not like they were
It was one of their first titles.
Yeah, it was one of their launch titles.
And I think it's only in retrospect they're realizing. I mean, look at Crackdown. Crackdown is almost... Almost the point to it is building up these
things.
On
the other hand, though, PGR3 was probably the best of the launch titles because Perfect Dark Zero was buggy as hell, which is unfathomable to me. And Cameo just seemed to me failed to make an impression at all.
Well, I enjoyed PGR3, but the minute I got Test Drive Unlimited, that to me was my kind of...
So that's the last thing on the list, is you talking about the Driving Everywhere achievement.
Well, so the achievement is, I mean, you're on the island of Oahu, and you have to... One of their achievements is to drive to what they call it, discover all the roads. Well, but the way it works is there's roads everywhere, but like a little... off ramp or on ramp, and you can tell if you discover them by looking on your GPS and seeing is like a bar across it to show you've driven there. But to drive every road, some of them it's you've been in that area, you've driven past this little, literally a 10-foot on ramp, but you got to go on that. But I'm like so close. I don't know. I mean, I'm right now I'm at eight. I've driven over 83% of the roads, so I'm like down to 17%, and it's like little areas where I feel compelled to just drive them back and forth to hit every area for this stupid 40 points, which would be, I don't even know why I'm doing it, but I feel completely compelled to do it. I don't know what's, you know, I've gotten pretty much every achievement. There's a couple other big ones that I will never do and I'll give up because it's getting the gold in every single thing. And these other missions are just too hard for me. But that one there, I don't know why. I'm just sitting here rhythmically. I think I'm doing it to pass the time to avoid, because I'm avoiding other things I should be doing. But I don't know. I mean,
in character.
I've got at least 5 more hours of driving random little roads with nothing. And there's nothing worse, too. The thing that makes, if you're into multiplayer games, Test Drive Unlimited great, is that you're on this island and you're encountering all these other people. And you can immediately challenge them, talk to them, do other stuff. Well, I could care less. I don't want to be part of that. I don't do anything. I've never used the headset. I just have no interest in that. And I'm sitting here driving these little areas. Well, the thing is as you're driving a little area, invariably you're encountering other people. And I turn, and I forgot, I haven't turned down the sound from people coming through the pike, but I've turned down the sound of my car driving. So it's so weird. I'll be driving through this area, filling out space, and periodically I'll hear over, "Hey, what's up? Hey, dude. Hey." You know, it's constantly random people speaking very loudly over my computer, and I just... And I ignore it because I don't have my thing on and I'm just filling out space. And then I disappear from their screen as I launch into another area. But anyway, so I'm gonna get that achievement. Then I'm going to say screw it. And I'm going to go back to Crackdown and start achievement whoring there. So,
all right. Well, good for you.
Yep.
No email this week.
Probably because there was no show until I posted it this morning. Which is my fault.
That could perhaps have been the reason.
I've just been very busy. We have our big cat show coming up in a couple weeks. I've been sort of swamped with that.
Alrighty then. You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com is how you contact us. And That's about it. I'm Matt.
Sorry, mid-yawn. I'm Richard.
And we have not been compelling enough for Richard. I apologize.
Goodbye.